leaders are good. And so here's C.S. Lewis, and here's Joy Gresham Davidson, who became his wife, and then he wrote this book, A Grief Observed. And this is kind of how he processed through that. And it shows us that there really is two ways to look at the problem of evil. The first is the existential problem, which basically means real life. And this is when we encounter people who are hurting. My wife lost her, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. She lost her mom when she was 15 years old. And she was a freshman and or sophomore in high school and was just absolutely broken. And she, if in that time, were to turn to her youth pastor or youth leader or pastor at her church and just was sobbing and broken and crying. And he said, well, and pulls out the problem of pain and begins to unpack four philosophical reasons why her mother died of cancer, right? It would have crushed her. So the first way we have to understand to deal with the problem of evil is real life. And in real life, people do not need us to back up the dump truck of information on them and begin to pile on evidences and philosophical explanations on why God allows evil to exist. That's when we hug. That's when we weep. As the scripture says, we weep with those who weep. We mourn with those who are in mourning. And so we have to remember that this is the pastoral response, listening, weeping, empathizing, and being with people in that time. But there will be a time in which we need to be prepared to give an intellectual answer to the problem of evil or a logical problem. And here's basically how it goes. This is what is often kind of laid out for the Christian. An all-powerful God would be able to eliminate evil because he's all-powerful. An all-knowing God would know how to do it. An all-loving God would want to do it. But evil exists, so therefore God either isn't powerful enough, not loving enough, he's not knowledgeable enough, or he doesn't exist, right? And so that's kind of thrown out there. And as Christians, we can't just go back to, well, the Bible says, you know, because this person's not, they're not tracking with the Bible. They don't care what the Bible says. They want an answer that makes sense to them in that moment. Give me an intellectual reason why God, who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving, allows a guy to climb up into the tower of Mandalay Bay and gun down 53 people, right? So answer that for me, Christian, right? And so that's kind of like the challenge given. And so what I want to do in just about a half hour together is begin to present a case for why an all-loving and all-powerful and all-knowing God allows evil to exist. And so we can look at it like this. Think of an illustration of scales. On one side, we've got evidence against God. And on one side, we've got evidence for God. And for the sake of this morning, what we're going to do is on the left side, on the against God side, we're going to stack up evil in the world. And at this point, it doesn't look really good for God because the amount of evil in the world is plentiful, let's just say. It is all around us, and we are never lacking for examples of evil and wickedness in our world. So how do we begin to tip the scales? How do we begin to answer this question so that people can at least begin to understand or at least have a little light bulb turned on in how to understand this? And so the first thing we need to do is to kind of ask the question, did God create evil? Because I think that's important. Because if God created evil, and evil is a thing that has been created, well, then it's relatively fair to say that God is the creator of evil, God is the author of evil. But we know that that's not true. And so how then do we define evil? So let me ask you a question. What is a donut hole? Deliciousness. Awesome. 13 for a dollar if you find a good bakery, right? It's always 13. As some of you may be thinking of something like this, right? I love me some good donut holes. Pop'ems are my current favorite. They're the old-fashioned ones, and we sell them in our shop just down here. Well, actually, we've been lied to. That's not a donut hole. What is a donut hole? A donut hole is the place where there is no donut, right? That's the donut hole. It's the place where there's no donut. Now, bakers have been very smart over the years to figure out a way to still make the donut with the hole and then have a usable bit of awesomeness to share and to sell on the side. So another example of this, what's a shadow, right? What is a shadow? a lack of light. Yeah, a shadow is the place where there is no light. So is a shadow a thing, or is it the absence of a thing? Right? It's one of the questions we have to begin to grapple with, because shadows are definitely real, right? They're real. They exist. But can you hug them? Right? Can you interact with them? Oh, sure, you can kind of play around and make yourself real small or real big, or make, you know, the birds or the snail or the whatever the different things are. You can interact with that, but in the end, a shadow is simply the absence of light. And so then we begin to ask the question, what is evil? So let's think about a knife for a second. Is a knife evil? Is a knife good? Yeah. A knife is good, absolutely good. But a knife is absolutely not evil, right? So we'll think about it in this way. So a tool, what about a knife used in the hands of a murderer? Does it change whether or not the knife is evil or good? No, it's still an object, right? Because what if that same knife was used? Now, if the same knife was used by a surgeon, go to a different surgeon. Let me just say, first, he's like, yeah, I got something that'll help you here. So then really what we see is that the knife is a thing, but it's not necessarily an evil thing or a good thing. What matters is the relationship between the tool and the user, right? Between the implement and the implementer. And in very much the same way, evil defines an improper relationship. Evil defines an improper relationship where there is the absence of good. And in same way in that a shadow is the absence of light, evil is the absence of good. It's not a thing. It's not a substance. You can't order it on Amazon, although I'm sure they're trying, because what can't you order on Amazon, right? You can't go down to the snack shop and order it unless you get a birthday cake milkshake, which is absolutely horrible. Just kidding. If you like birthday cake ice cream, it's more power to you. But you can't see it, you can't order it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it. You can experience it, but what you're experiencing is an improper relationship. What you're experiencing is the absence of good. And so when we talk about evil, we can't look at it as a created thing. It's an intruder. It's an invader. And so how do we begin to then discuss this? Because if God creates all and all is good, well, then we begin to see that evil has intruded into this. But how did evil intrude? How did evil first come on the scene? And that's where we get to kind of our first way of looking at this or answering this. And some of you may have heard of this before and maybe studied it extensively, and it's called the free will defense. And so let me for a second ask you, how many of you are parents? Okay, or either currently or past, right? And so those of you who are parents, there's this really interesting thing that begins to happen somewhere between third and fourth grade and high school, and it's different for every parent, and it's the Sunday morning church experience, right? When they're second, third, fourth grade, they can't wait to go see Miss Susie, and they're gonna maybe win candy, and they're saying their verses, and it's this really fun thing, and there's characters and puppets and flannel boards or whatever it is, right? And then flannel boards, okay, come on. Some of you I know are from small churches and you still use flannel boards, right? Okay, I wish. Wouldn't that be cool? I loved flannel boards. My favorite was, okay, this is off subject. Zacchaeus, right? You do this, you'd have the crowd piece of flannel, you'd have the tree flannel, you'd have Jesus, and then Zacchaeus was always like an inch tall, and he'd be up on the sycamore tree. It was really cool. Anyway, delete that from the recording also. Sometime, at some point, you'll have that Sunday morning conversation. It's time to get ready for church. And the answer is, I don't want to go to church. And if you're a good parent, like I was, of course, you say, you get your butt up. And you, right? Like that's the first response. The very air you breathe is a gift from me to you. So you will get out of that bed. You will go to church one day, and you start into the whole thing, right? You'll be on your own, making your own decisions. You pay your car insurance and all that kind of stuff. And you can choose to go, right? Because what we know in our head is that it would be far better for our sons and daughters to choose to go to church rather than to be forced to go to church. Because we all know intuitively that a world in which there is choice and that there is freedom is a qualitatively better world than a world in which we are forced. Think for a second that if we lived in a world in which every decision was made for you, right? So the government chooses everyone's jobs. They choose what time you start. You may only take 15 minutes to get ready for work, but it doesn't matter because at 6:57 a.m., a piercing, ear-piercing noise goes off all across the world, and every single person must get up, and every single person must go to the same exact car that is tuned to the same exact NPR radio station at volume 8, and you can't change it, right? You have one route to go to work. There is one choice for your breakfast cereal. There is one place you can go, right? We would be crazy to believe that that would be a world we would want to live in. Because we know that the ability to choose brings that richness and meaning into our lives. And so in the very same way, God creates all and all is good. But God also, in his goodness and in his love, gives the ability for his created beings to choose. Of course, the hope, the plan, is that we choose love, that we choose care, that we choose concern, that we choose empathy, that we choose self-sacrifice, that we choose gracious parenting, that we choose, right, all of these things as Christ loved the church, right, and gave himself up for her. That's how we're supposed to love our wives and that we would choose to do that. But in our world, the gift that God has given us is that he has given us the ability to choose both good and to choose the opposite of good. And so, and again, this makes sense as you begin to think of it. But some people would say, well, okay, I get it. But can't God maybe just stop the really bad things? Right? I want to be able to cheat on my taxes, and I don't want God to stop me. Right? I want to be able to go and look at porn on my computer and not have the internet crash every time I try. I want to be able to yell at my kids when I'm angry and not have God stop me. But I don't want other people to go grab weapons and kill people. I don't want Hitler to massacre 2 million Jews. I don't want, right? So why can't God just stop the really bad things? So in other words, what they're saying is, I would like the Lord to allow all evil that suits me, but not the evil that suits other people, especially when other people's evil affects my sense of what I think is good. And right? And so if this guy is like, it's super simple. I want to be able to skim a little bit off the top of my company. I want to be able to look at stuff on the computer I shouldn't look at. But what if this other guy wants to just steal a little bit of stuff from someone's house? And this other guy wants to just do a little bit of this, or this other guy wants to invade his home and like do awful things to his children, right? I mean, like, well, no, God should stop those. So what we're saying then is this God who we're pretty skeptical of in the first place, we want him to choose some sort of imaginary line at which evil becomes too evil and stop those things, but we still want to be able to choose our own evil. And so it logically doesn't make any sense. We begin to understand that in a world in which we're truly free to choose means that we are free to choose both the awesome and the holy and pure and the far opposite of that. A world in which we are free to choose means that we are able to choose without those restrictions. And so I'm a parent of two boys, and I got to say, there are times in which I am a great parent, and there are times in which I am a horrible parent. I would shudder to think, and most of you guys would feel the same way, that if somehow you found out that your lives had been being recorded, right, and then just you go into work one day, and it's like, hey, we made a highlight of your last 7 days at home, and we just want to show them up on the screen. Like, there's going to be times where I literally go from Bruce Banner to the Hulk in 10 seconds for no apparent reason at all, and I just turn into smash mode, right? Like, this other weekend, my older son, who's away at college, was home for the weekend, and the kids were kind of just like, bim, 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 and I was starting to go, brrr, right, just kind of up, and then for some reason, the final straw was our oldest son, Caleb, was up in the loft and he was running downstairs just like, go, 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 go. And we've already broken two of the treads in the staircase in this little house we live in here that was built in 1942. And I just went, Caleb! And I just was like, oh, right? And the whole house like shook. And my wife, of course, goes, I'm sure the neighbors appreciated that, right? And I'm like, I don't care. And I just was, it was so just like maddening to me. And I had to just kind of stop and go, where did that come from? Now, there's other times when my son comes in the room and I'm like, hey, bud, come here. And there, he's 18 and my other son's 16 and I put him on my knee and I start playing with his hair and rubbing his back and he just goes, oh yeah, right? And I'm scratching his back and playing with his hair and I find that when I do that, he's the most open about his day, right? He's still 5 years old, rubbing his back and playing with his hair. He starts telling me, oh, I was working today and this and that. And I had this great moment with ends with me hugging him saying, I love him. How meaningless would those times be if I couldn't also be the Hulk? Right? If in the construct of our relationship, there was no ability for me to be the biggest jerk monster in the whole world, then the times of the loving, sweetness, and the caring would have far less meaning. In a world where we could only choose to love, love would be lost. Love wouldn't be meaningful. We'd be robotic creatures. Here's what C.S. Lewis says. We're going to lean on him pretty heavily this morning, and I'm getting woefully behind, but I need to read this to you. God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go wrong or right. Some people think they can imagine a world or creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong, but I can't. If a thing is free to be good, it's also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why then did God give people a will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. So the free will defense in its basic form in our 8 minutes we've talked about it is saying evil exists partially because God has given us free will. And in that free will, he has created beings which can choose to love and serve and empathize and self-sacrifice and also can choose to do evil. And the concept that God could then just only stop the really, really bad things falls apart because by whose definition? Right? Is not a guy wrecking his marriage through an extramarital affair really, really evil? Yeah, it completely is. Is it more evil than murder? I honestly don't know. They're both really evil, right? I mean, just so, and we could get into subjects of war and all those kind of things. And so it's a difficult proposition to begin to argue once you introduce the idea of free will. So we put this on the side then of God, and it begins to kind of balance these scales. So let's look at another one kind of quickly. Second one is God has morally sufficient reasons to allow evil. God has morally sufficient reasons to allow evil. Think for a second how finite we are. Just how, I mean, maybe you got a chance in the last couple nights to look up at the stars. And if you didn't, I encourage you to get away, even if you just walk down the Hume Lake Trail for about 5 minutes, maybe even three, and get away from the lights of the dining hall. It's just like, wow. And there are several times I've been with my wife and kids up at a place called Inspiration Point, which is up the hill here, looking at stars and see the Milky Way, and we see shooting stars and satellites and just think, I am tiny. I'm tiny compared to how infinite God is. I remember as a child, our elementary school I went to had sinks on both sides and mirrors on both sides in a perfectly rectangle room, these long wall-length mirrors. And you'd stand there and you'd see it go ding, 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 back and forth, right? And eventually, because the glass wasn't perfect, it would slowly make a curve, right? And this corridor of reflections would turn and turn and turn into basically what I felt like was infinity until I couldn't see it anymore. And you could kind of wave and see yourself back and forth, back and forth. And I remember just standing there and thinking, wow, heaven is going to take so long. I remember as a little kid going, What are we going to do for eternity? Like, I can't believe this, and I can't believe how big God is, and I can't believe how smart he is and how powerful he is. And we don't have any idea sometimes what God is doing. And there are times in which he has morally sufficient reasons to allow evil to happen because he sees things we can't. He sees things that we can't because he has already been there in the future. So I don't have time to show the clip this morning. There's a movie called Sliding Doors. It's an old movie, starred Gwyneth Paltrow and this other guy that I can't remember his name. He's been in movies and I can't remember his name. And I don't expect you to either. But the movie's got a very interesting premise. In the first clip, which I'll just describe to you, Gwyneth is trying to catch a subway and she's rushing down the stairs and this girl drops a toy and it causes her to dodge right and kind of catch her steps. And then she gets to the subway just as the doors are closing. And she's like, and the subway train leaves. And then it goes, and it goes backwards, right? And she's running down the stairs again. And this time the girl is about to drop the toy and the mom grabs her arm and pulls her aside and Gwyneth slips right by her and gets in and goes, ching, and peels the door open and gets on and sits down. And the movie then begins to go in two completely different directions, bouncing back and forth two realities. One reality is the reality in which she caught the subway and the other reality is in which she didn't. Right, and on the subway she meets this guy, and off the subway she does this other thing, and it goes in two totally, completely different paths because of what seemed like a minute thing. In a similar way, we have no idea the repercussions of events. We don't know what God is doing in those down the future. We can only be in the moment, and in the moment there is real hurt. And in the moment, there is suffering. My wife, Tiffany, about 9 years ago, or no, 7 years ago, we got to go to Hawaii. This is later. I don't know how that jumped in there. Oh, sorry. Nope. So sorry. Something got out of place here. It's like one of my slides got deleted. Oh, pardon this for a second, guys. Yeah. Yeah, you got a question? Let me scroll down to this. All right, sorry. I made an edit and then to change it. So this is my wife, Tiffany. She's beautiful, love her. We've been married for 23 years. About 7 years ago, we got a chance to go to Hawaii with our boys. It was like this thing we've been saving up forever. And this shot was taken on the Big Island and it's just was an incredible time. We came back from that trip in March. And then in September, she had a mammogram appointment. I mentioned to you that her mother passed away when she was a freshman. So her mom died of breast cancer, so they've been doing tests on her more early and regular than they do them on most women. And from what I understand, mammograms are not super comfortable. I've heard that. and it's not maybe something that is super exciting to go and do. And so I kind of was, you know, like, nudging her, you gotta remember to go. And she was really good about being consistent and going, but I was always kind of nervous. And so I'm like, hey, make sure you always get, you know, do your appointment. And she called me and she goes, the traffic's terrible. I'm not gonna make my appointment. I'm gonna have to cancel it. And I was like, oh, gosh darn it. Okay, well, make sure, you know, we do that. So fast forward to December, she has a mammogram, and that's an important part of the story. But, and they find a little something. They say, we wanna do another test, and another test, another test. And in January of that following year, we found out that she had breast cancer. And we began to find out then that she also had the cancer gene and that when they discovered it, it was so small that if she would have had the mammogram appointment in September, they wouldn't have found it. But that between September and December, they were able to see it. So even this, it's not even where I was going to go with that, but a small little thing like traffic, right? God, why? Why? Because God has morally sufficient reasons to allow things because of what he sees. So anyway, we found out that she had cancer, and then found out that it was different than they thought, and it was actually invasive, and it was on both sides, and So this was 11 months after this picture was taken. We took this picture, which was on Good Friday. We decided it was time to shave her head because the chemo was causing so many clumps of hair to come out, right? And she probably ended up having 4 or 5 surgeries over the course of this year, and chemo and all sorts of craziness in this. And it was an incredibly difficult time, you know, in our lives. I'm happy to report she's doing really well. Here she is down here. This is 2 summers ago. We got to go to chance to go to Scotland, and her hair's grown back. She thinks there's more gray than there was before, but I told her that's because she's older. I said it in a loving way. But she's beautiful. She's beautiful. In that moment, we had all sorts of reasons to ask God, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" Now, we were in a great place. God had strengthened our marriage in a way that we had no idea what he was doing it for, but he had been preparing us for it. And what we didn't know is that God would use what was going on in her life to give her a platform to begin to minister to more ladies than I can count who were going through cancer, who gave her the opportunity to speak publicly with hundreds of women to share what God was doing in her story. For us to elevate the sovereignty of God while being a pastor at a church on staff, while suffering through cancer, while going through surgeries, for us to be able to move from head knowledge like God is good, God is loving, he is sovereign, he chooses, God is in heaven, and he does as he pleases, as the psalmist says, right? Then to live that and experience that. And you guys, we would change nothing about what God has taken us through because of what he has shown faithful to do and to develop in us as a result of this evil. And cancer is an evil. Cancer is an intruder. There isn't probably anyone in this room who hasn't been touched or affected by it, either personally or through loved ones. Why does God allow it to happen? Why haven't we found a cure yet? I don't know. But I know there are times in which he allows that because he knows what he's going to build because of it, and through it is far more beautiful than anything that could have existed in health. And so here's what C.S. Lewis says. He says, "What do people mean when they say that I'm not afraid of God because I know he's good? Have they never been to a dentist?" I love that. It's like, I'm not afraid of the dentist because I know the dentist is good. Yeah, said by someone who's never been to a dentist, right? Does not a dentist have morally sufficient reasons to allow pain? Does not a doctor have morally sufficient reasons to take a knife and to slice into someone's back or stomach, right? Yes, of course they do. Because again, they see a bigger picture that we can't often see. I remember when we had our puppy, Bella, and I was so cheap that I did not want to take her to the vet. And we lived in Chino, right? And there's tons of horse and animal and cow feed stores and that kind of stuff. They sell vaccinations. And you can go and for like $6 buy your own vaccination. I'm like, sweet, this is awesome. So I take my little puppy and I read the instructions, right? I'm a total pro. I got to do that thing where you hold the needle and you go, and you squeeze out the top, like, yeah. And then I grab her little scruff of her neck and I stick it in and she just goes, like, what are you doing, right? Because just minutes earlier, I'm like, oh, lick my face, you know, puppy, right? I had morally sufficient reasons to cause pain for the purpose of protecting her in the long term. And so, again, we can unpack this more, but we add this to the list. I'm not saying this is true for every single thing, but I am saying one of the ways that we can begin to answer it is that God sees what we can't see. And as awful as it is for us to wrap our heads around that, there are times that God uses evil, whether evil caused by other humans or evil caused naturally, like a hurricane or an earthquake or a tornado, because what it does is it brings out the best of the best people in this world. It brings out the best character traits of the best people in this world and causes men and women to rise up and prove their character in times of difficulty and suffering. We don't know if that's why he allows certain things like that to happen, but it certainly is one of the reasons. He is all good, and all that he does is good, even if at the time we can't see it. like I said, we're going to be up against it here. Let me give a third one. Evil itself is evidence for God. Evil itself is an evidence for God. So I a couple years ago, got really into watching our U.S. soccer teams play, both on the men's and women's sides. It's just what I thought was an incredibly boring game, probably because when I was a kid, all I did was pick the grass and run around and have no idea what was going on. But as I began to get a little older and watch and begin to appreciate a game that ends with like 1-0, right? And just to kind of watch a little of that, I've since fallen out of that, and now I think it's really boring again. But there was a time when I thought this was really enthralling, right? I was totally, it was like, USA, right? And I wanted to pick up one of those horns, the flugo, yeah, those things. You know, I thought it was so cool, right? And we were all about USA. Picture for a second, one of our U.S. soccer, you know, players is running a little late to the game, shows up and is like, oh gosh, you know, and runs out on the field and they start playing and then just get a brutal slide tackle right into their calf. This guy wasn't even going for the ball, just fully up cleats right into his calf. He's on the ground and what is he rolls over, looks at the ref and he's expecting to see, and there's a yellow card, there's a red card, something is going to fly. And the ref's like, oh, you know, hey, and they keep running. And this guy goes, wait, what? What are you doing? And the ref's like, oh, sorry. Hey, time out. John was late. John, before the game started, you missed this. We asked each team to go ahead and make up whatever rules they wanted to of what they would allow and not allow. And your team chose that you could shoot penalty kicks from 5 feet closer than usual, but their team chose that they could try to injure you guys without any consequence. So, play on, right? And what does John on the ground yell? Like, that's not fair. That's not right. Because we know that there are certain things that describe the way that the world should be. And then there are other things that are an aberration, things that go against that. And the very times that we call out something for not being fair, or not being good, or for being evil, betrays something in us. And that's that we know that there is a way things ought to be, and there is a way things that things ought not to be. And so we call these moral standards universal moral truths that people will fight against, and they'll say don't exist until you steal their stuff, right? Then they believe in universal moral truth. Right? And I don't want to get graphic or gross here, but there is nobody that says, yes, everybody can choose for themselves what's right or wrong, who believes that when someone decides to rape their 5-year-old daughter. Right? That line has been crossed. Oh, well, that's because the government has made that illegal. Really? You think that's wrong because the government made it illegal? So if the government made it legal, you would just go along with it? No, of course not. Because we know there's a way things ought to be. We know when things are not fair. Richard Dawkins, who is an atheist, we call him a happy atheist. He's like, want to hang out with that guy. Here is what he says about this subject. He says, the God of the Old Testament is arguably, listen to this, the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. Jealous and proud of it, petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilent, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Okay, don't hold back. Like, tell us, Richard, how do you feel? Like, tell us, just use your words, right? I mean, just, what is he saying? God is evil. God is evil. He is horrible, awful, wicked. But yet what's interesting in his other books, he wrote this book called River Out of Eden. And here's what he says. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replications, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. And then he goes on to say this, the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect it to have if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind pitiless indifference. You can't have it both ways. So basically what Richard Dawkins is saying is, yeah, sometimes things stink. Sorry about your luck. But yet, he's also more than willing to call God all sorts of things when he sees wickedness in the world. But yet, he wants to, on the other side, just attribute it to random genetic factoring. If you say that God is evil, you must have a standard. You've got to have, how can you call God malevolent and vindictive and bloodthirsty if you don't know what the opposites of those are? So the very existence of evil also points to then the existence of good and ultimately to a creator who created good things. Lewis says this, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed to be cruel and unjust. But how did I get this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of what a straight line looks like. What was I comparing this line, this universe with when I called it unjust? How can you say something's unjust when you don't know what just is?" And so this, here's what it looks like. And I'll talk about sending you guys the notes after because I know we're flying through this. Evil is a departure from the way things ought to be. The way things ought to be implies a moral standard. A moral standard or law implies a moral law giver or creator. And we argue that God is the moral law giver. And Christianity, gentlemen, I believe is the only worldview which answers this question in at least a somewhat intellectually satisfying way. That God is the moral law giver because we certainly didn't come up with it on our own. There is far too much diversity in this world and differings of opinions. I mean, there are societies in which you can kill them, kill people, and then eat them. And that's a sign of manhood, right? Now, do we say that's wrong? Mm-hmm, yeah, I'm gonna go with that, yes, absolutely. Do not wanna be eaten, right? I don't. But who are we to judge another culture for what they have said is right or wrong? I'll tell you who we are. We are people created in the image of God who inherently have a moral code because there is a moral code giver. And when we go astray from that and when that becomes broken, it becomes very evident that something is not as it should be. Evil is evidence. And then finally, a final thing we could look at is this idea of character building or soul making. That God is not just interested in giving us pleasure. God is not interested in just giving us pleasure. We are sold this lie. And then when pain comes, we're like, what? Why? This is not fair. Why is God letting me do this? And I would argue that that is someone, if that's a Christian, who doesn't really understand or read Scripture. Think about this. James says this in chapter 1. "Consider it joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, knowing that the testing of your faith develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so that you may be complete or mature and lacking in nothing." We are told about the reality of suffering many, many, many times in Scripture, not just if it happens, but when it happens. In fact, we're told that we are most like Christ when we are in periods of suffering. It is then that we have maybe even just a teensy taste of what he went through for us. God is not interested in your comfort alone. Think of I don't know if any of you, if you did this, you probably wish you wouldn't have, and you've seen your mistakes, hopefully. But does anyone know someone who has absolutely spoiled their kids to the point where they have become rotten kids? I mean, like some of you, you're like this guy and that guy right there. But just absolutely where they were never told no. They were the center of their universe. Okay, at some point, the real world comes into play, right? And at some point, someone is going to cause them hardships or difficulties or tell them no, and that child has been ruined by the lack of discipline and no and consequences and whatever may come, whether that's in the forms of spankings for doing the wrong things or timeouts or losing things or whatever it is. And in the same way, a person who has never gone through minor sufferings and difficulties or trials in their lives, when they're hit by something cataclysmic, can just absolutely collapse because there's no foundation holding up that person's character. Because character, as we know, is not formed and built when everything goes our way. Some parts of it are, but for the most part, our character is built when we are in the crucible, when we are put to the flame. That's when those impurities begin to be drawn up to the surface, and the Lord can work with us to scrape those off. And so another reason that evil is allowed is because God uses difficulties and hardships and suffering to build in us what we could not and actually would not build in ourselves, because we would aim for the easy life. When my wife, when we were in there and we were about to get this final thing and we met with and two people walked in, not just one, we thought, oh no, this isn't a doctor going like, hey, everything's gonna be great. But I still wanted it. I still wanted it to be all cleared. I still wanted, and we had like six tests along the way, and each of them could have gone this way or that way. And if they went this way, it's great news, and this way is bad news. And every single time, do you know where it went? Middle. Every single test went to the middle, where it would have been far easier if it was like, it's the absolute worst thing, here's what you have to do. And instead it was, hey, so here are your options. And each time we had to choose gut-wrenching decisions, like to have a double mastectomy instead of going for lumpectomy. But we had to make that choice, and it wasn't just like, it's absolutely clear, you have to do this. We were in the middle, and I'm telling you, those conversations defined our character and built us up, because God, in his love for us, what does Paul say in 2 Corinthians? Allows this momentary light affliction, which in the scope of humanity is momentary light affliction, because he's building for us, producing in us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. We look not at the things that are seen, but the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Lewis says it like this: God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, but shouts to us in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And so we have these four things: this free will defense, morally sufficient reasons, character building, and evil as evidence for God. There are many other things we could look at, which end up being also ways that we can prove the existence of God. Cosmological cause argument, the design argument, moral law argument. We have all sorts of things that we can say. Bertrand Russell, another famous atheist, though, counters and says this: who could believe in a good God if they've sat beside the bedside of a dying child? But I would say to Bertrand Russell, well, what's your alternative? I mean, I said this earlier, you guys. I believe that Christianity offers the most complete and compelling worldview to answer this question of evil and suffering. What other alternative is there? When you sit by the bedside of a dying child, oh man, sorry about your luck. In a world of blind electrons and protons, some people just die. And other people, you know, right? But it's good, because then when he's gone, he'll just go into eternal nothingness and you'll be left here to be at the hand of random fate yourself, alone without your child, right? I mean, like, What is the alternative? Rather than to point that person, no matter how difficult it is in that moment, to a God who loves us enough to not create robots with no choice, who loves us enough to shape our character even through the most difficult of times. This doesn't make it easy. This doesn't make it all in a neat package, because we still have a very difficult problem in answering even the question of natural evils. Well, I get it. You know, some guy named Bill can grab a gun and go kill 12 people, but who caused the earthquakes? Who causes the hurricanes? Who causes Santa Rosa fire, which for all intents and purposes, as far as we know, still has not been proven to be anything but a lightning strike? Unless I'm wrong, we don't get the news up here. I'm kidding, we do. we still have problems. We still have questions to ask. And talk about that just for a second, this issue of natural evil. It is one of the more difficult things to say, because for someone who doesn't buy into a creator God who loves us, they are not willing to kind of see some of this. But let me just throw out a couple things to think about for that. Number one, in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah receives a vision from the Lord. He says, go down to the house of the potter. There's something I want to tell you. So Jeremiah goes down to the house of the potter. The potter is shaping clay pots, and he's fashioning something on the spinning wheel. And then the potter becomes displeased with it. And for some reason, whatever reason he wanted to, because he's the potter and it's clay, he goes, whoop, crushes it down, forms it into a ball, tightens it up, slaps it down on the wheel, and begins to reform something else. And the Lord pulls Jeremiah aside and says, am I not the potter? And does not the potter have the right to shape the clay however the potter sees fit? And how ludicrous would it be for the clay to rise up against the potter and say, make me this way, make me that way, do this, do that. Like when we were playing Play-Doh as kids, right? Not eating it, playing with it, and squeezing it through and making a little man, and then we didn't like what we made, and we shove it down to a ball again. We mix the colors, much to our siblings' chagrin, right? And we build something else. And at no point does the Play-Doh ever rise up outside of a horror movie and declare to us what we should be doing with it. So one thing we have to remember, as difficult as it is that if the Lord in his sovereignty allows for thousands of people to be wiped out by an earthquake, Christians, he is the potter. He is the life giver. If that's what he chooses to do, that's what he chooses to do. Now, please don't go tell that to your non-Christian friends. Don't just throw that out the very first thing. But it's something, men, we must understand about the sovereignty of God, that it is his prerogative. We also have other things that come into this. Men, throughout centuries, have been wooed by the wrong things. They're wooed by oceans and coastal views, regardless of fault lines. And I don't mean that as a joke. I mean consistently areas are decimated by earthquakes because of man's greed and because of their desire for the wrong things. They rebuild the same place. How many times has the Caribbean been wiped out by tornadoes? And how many times do men continue to rebuild there? Now, I'm not saying it's an easy solution. I'm not saying I have an answer for all of this, but there is a bit of this. There is also, especially in Haiti, a broken and shady government who, because of greed, allowed for building codes and all sorts of wickedness to take place in the laws and the rules of how they build and where they let people live and their housing and all those kind of things. And so when an earthquake hits, the loss of life is immense. And some of that is because of the wickedness of man. And then some of this is because the very same weather systems that allow us to have rain, that build our crops and bring us snow and water, are the same weather systems that can bring destruction. And I'm not saying that we can't have it, like only the good things can happen and not the bad, but part of it is the same God who we call to and ask him to bring rain makes other decisions, but as soon as those decisions are ones we don't like, we rage against him, right? And so again, none of these are one shot, put the silver bullet in, take aim at that doubter and fire, and boom, all the answers are taken. All the answers are answered. No, it doesn't work that way. And so we need to look at this problem of evil from both the existential, which is someone is hurting and grieving. You do not back up your dump truck of answers and say, well, let me give you four reasons why God allowed this. No. And there are going to be other times in which you are going to give a reasonable answer and someone is not going to buy in. They're not going to be on board. And we have to deal with that. And so maybe for you guys this morning, this has been a spark. I just want to look at this slide and just ask the question, what are your expectations of God? Because maybe for some of you, you've been holding God to promises he never made. And I'll tell you, and I mean this as a friend to you guys and as a pastor and a guy who loves you, if you hold God to promises that he has never made, you will constantly be frustrated and disappointed with God. If you allow yourself to believe that God only wants good for you, and by your definition of good, not his, if God only wants the easy road for you, if God only wants health and wealth and prosperity and a nice car and easy living, and then you hold him to those things, or you hold God to the fact that he didn't heal the person you wanted healed, when Scripture doesn't actually say that everyone who you want healed gets healed. God's the potter, and we're the clay. What are your expectations of him? And so we're late, and we got to get going here. If this has sparked in you guys a desire to know more, there are three or four books that I would recommend, and I'd also love to send you a PDF of these notes as well as a worksheet to go along with this. And so I'm going to have a notebook and a pen over here on this table, and if you'll just write down your email address in English. Last week, I had like three guys, I don't know what language it was, but I couldn't send them the email. I tried 18 different ways, and it kept getting returned. So all caps, use your best second grade penmanship. But if you give me your email address, I'll send you these notes. And I just want to pray with you guys, because I know that this is a subject which touches us personally oftentimes in very difficult ways. And while this morning I hope to give you some sort of reasonable answers, coming to a peace with this is really something that only comes by continual pressing into the Lord and getting to that place where here's all the things we know to be true about God. Here's all the things that are questions and frustrations. And are you willing to allow those continued to be mysteries in your life because of what you know to be true, what you know to be factual about who God is? Will you have the willingness to allow some questions to be unanswered? Because this side of heaven, there are certain things that God does that I will never understand. And I have to be okay with that. I mean, in a small micro level, there are things my wife does that I will never understand, right? But listen, I didn't mean to evoke laughter because this is serious. But the bulk of information I know to be true about her character outweighs the questions and the mysteries. And I'll gladly accept the mysteries and the questions in exchange for what I know to be true about her. And we just need to have a bold enough faith to get to that place to see the evidence for God stacked up so greatly on one side that on the other, we're willing to live in the mystery, this side of heaven. What are your expectations of God? I think it's an important question to ask. Let's pray, and then we'll head to our next thing. And if you want to stick around and ask some questions, we can do that. God, wow, from power outage to talking about evil and wickedness, Lord, I thank you for this time that we're able to spend together and to share not only from your word, but also from what we see and experience in the world around us to begin to answer the question of why. God, we know that you are good. We know that you are loving. And when I say that, I know that those can be difficult to swallow sometimes, especially when tragedy hits us in the face. God, would you point us to what we know to be true about you? Would you heal the wounds that wickedness and evil have caused? And we didn't really even talk about the wickedness and evil that we cause, and how other people are faced with the problem of evil because of us and because of the way that we've treated, the way that we've responded. So God, would you forgive us for the role that we play in propagating wickedness in this world? Would you forgive us? And God, in these areas where there are questions and doubts and misunderstandings and mysteries, Lord, would you give us the strength of character to pursue answers to those, to where we are satisfied in our ability to trust you? And God, if we have situations that we don't know what to do in, would you give us the strength of character to seek counsel in those things? God, we love you, not just for what you do for us that's comfortable, but for everything that you do. And we give you praise. We know that you are about your glory. You are about our good. Help us to understand what that good looks like and not long for the wrong things. In your name, amen.